Blog Talk Radio.
And the war. That's why me respect you, and I believe in you, and I see your struggle. I never fear your strength. I never say you weak. I when them fear your pain, they're not gonna let you speak. Black woman, the black power. I say, 'cause I'm daughter. Black woman, the black power. Africa's own daughter, she got her soul and the spirit, black woman to the limit. I say this one's for you, black to the limit, all in the spirit. Talk about your hair or your shoes or the clothes that you wear. I talk about your mind. I talk about your courage. I they talk about your strength, your hopes and how you manage to achieve so much when they give you so little. Cursing the vicious cycle, the victim of every battle. I tell them how you conscious. I tell them say you serious. I tell them how you better. Say you precious and you precious. Ah, black woman of your skin tone. Black woman wear your apple. Black woman of your skin tone. Black woman wear your apple. You feel your skin if you go blink so. So you just have to see the picture. You look good in your apple. So you just have to foreign scripture. Black woman wear your apple. Black woman of your skin tone. Say black woman wear your afro. Black woman of the skin so. Kill your skin if you go bleach so. No bleach of skin for nobody. I said this was for you. She fight for every little thing that she gets. She struggles for every little thing that she be. She struggles to go to school. She struggles to vote. Maya Angelou, Angela Davis, Zaina Badawi, Nina Mina, Nina Simone.
Welcome to another segment of New Day, Resurrection and Liberation. Of course, we started out with something called Black Woman. Black African Woman. Yes, indeed. And we played that because many are and will be commemorating tomorrow, Mother's Day. And so we thought it was appropriate to play something that was suitable for us as the original mother. Well, today was a great day. We did our second session over at the Sarasep Society, also known as the Nile Gardens. And if you haven't been there, you need to check it out. Great food, wonderful vibes. And we're so blessed to feel the energy and to be received to be able to do now some of the work that we have to do in our community here in Philadelphia. So big shout out to our family over at the Nile Gardens. Yes, and for those who came out today, we thank all of you so very, very much for coming out and sharing the vibration. And when I say vibration, OMG. There was such a, today was powerful in terms of the frequencies that was being put out there today. It was truly, truly a wonderful experience. We said today would be a day for healing, and it was. I mean, we definitely was feeling some things up in there that was more than just beneficial. It was definitely not, something that was just the norm. You know, there was some real powerful kind of energies going on up in there today. So big shout out to Sister Doreen, who is our new I'm sure some of you have already experienced, working with the bowls, the singing bowls, and that's what she calls them, the singing bowls. Well, it was doing more than singing today, family, because I had the opportunity to obtain one of her gifts as the example of what she does with the bowls, and I'm telling you, it was really, really powerful and very much appreciated. So we had that today, and then we had Sister Khadija Renee, who is a vocalist, and in what we just heard, the clip we just heard, of course, Brother Kuti mentioned Nina Simone. Well, my sister today just brought the spirit of our great Nina Simone up in the room. She is one of our sister saints, meaning the National Million Women March Universal Movements. We now have 25 sister saints. And so you're going to hear more about what we're going to be doing for each one of those sister saints. Each one has a specific project, program that we now will be implementing. Today, of course, in the presentation, Sister Khadija Renee mentioned that Mama Queen Saint Nina was in Philadelphia for a while. She lived in Philadelphia for a while. She was a child prodigy. And, of course, she was able to do a tryout at one of the most prestigious institutions for music, which is here in Philadelphia, called the Curtis School of Music. Well, needless to say, during that time period, early 50s, I believe it was, you know, dark folks wasn't getting a whole lot of opportunities up in this place. And so certainly, even though Saint Nina was extremely gifted, well, she was denied entry. She was a denied admission. They said she just wasn't up to par. Yet we're talking about a child who was playing piano classically by the age of five, roughly. So, you know, we knew how that goes. But it really had an effect on her. It really kind of broke her heart a little bit and it broke her spirit a little bit at a very young age. She, of course, got over it to some degree, but as quiet as it's kept, she really did want to be a concert pianist. And I know that firsthand because I had the opportunity to meet her when I was in college. I interviewed her, just she and I, one-on-one. And I can never really convey how, you know, incredible that was. But the point is, she never really got over not being accepted. And not so much as accepted, but she had the gift. She knew that. And she loved piano, but she also loved the different types of piano music, and she really wanted to play, and they really would not allow her. So, of course, ultimately, she went into the field of, you know, what some call jazz, what many others call classical black music, and the rest is history. Well, Sister Khadija brought it today with four women. And I put a spell on you. She literally performed that today. So we kind of wanted to get that feeling and spirit of the mother. And, of course, Nina Simone represents that for many of us, particularly as the Million Women March now moves forward with what we call mothers, daughters, sisters of the movement, real mothers, daughters, sisters of the movement, not some stuff that, you know, is just kind of put into the press or the media in a certain kind of way. We're talking about sisters who really was fighting for justice and liberation for our people. This is what we mean when we say mothers, daughters, sisters of the movement. So, you know, it is what it is, but moving right along. So we did that today. And this is our second session we're going to be doing every month over at the Nile Gardens. And we're going to be doing other things in our communities as well. Oops, hold on one moment. Baba Oduna, we're waiting for you to call in.
Well, the number that I worked with was one.
Okay, no, I'll text it to you because we're on the air.
Are we on the air now?
Well, no, I mean, you're on my regular phone, but I need you to call in. Okay.
That 827 and I have to put the passcode?
No, I'll text it to you right now. Okay, so hang up and I'll text it. Or do you want me to call you? Okay, so we were waiting for Baba to call in, and I think, give me one moment, Sammy, I need to text him this information so that he can call in. And we're talking about Baba Oduna. He is one of our guests for tonight, and we're going to talk about, how many know about Nanny Helen Burroughs? How many know about Nanny Helen Burroughs? Well, Baba Oduna is going to call in a few moments, and he's going to share with us some incredible information about Nanny Helen Burroughs. Okay, family, give me 1 minute. I just got to make sure I text him the correct number because it looks like he's using another number from something else and probably one of our Zoom meetings. But I just sent that to him, so he should be checking in a minute. In the meantime, we're going to also talk to Sister Sheila Brown. She joined us earlier today also. And, of course, she has a book, the Divine Queendom. And it's a approach to black women, for black women, to deal with self-care. And so she kind of gave us some information today from her book, but also from some of her experiences and the work that she's really developing in some other realms of her work. She's so multifaceted that, you know, it's kind of hard to keep up with it sometimes, but listen, she's doing it, and we are very, very thankful. But she's going to be joining us tonight in a different way, meaning she just came back from Geneva, Switzerland. Yep, Geneva, Switzerland. Now, for many that do not know, we are literally getting ready to end the International Decade for African People. And so now headway is being made to represent all of our people globally in the United Nations. Now, if you've been kind of following our work with MWM and the We Trust Genocide, then, of course, you know that's a major part of what we're doing right now, and that is establishing our position in international circles, and, of course, that deals with human rights, our human rights. Now, next week, we will be commemorating El Hajj Malik El Shabazz Earth Day. And if you're in the Philadelphia area, we hope that you might want to go with us when we go to New York for the annual Malcolm X pilgrimage. And we'll tell you a little bit about that a little later on. But the point is, of course, Brother Malcolm went to Africa on our behalf to talk with heads of state about human rights violations of our people, and, of course, to ask for their support. Well, here we are today, and we're ready to follow up. We're ready to meet with African countries, representatives, organizations, to see how we can now get support for our human rights justice initiatives here, because we've always responded to other folks, and so now we want a reciprocity in place. So, we'll tell you more about that a little later on, too. Before we do, again, big shout-out to Sister Keisha, who joined us last night, Thorough Black Talk, when we had our interview with Ramona Africa. Come to find out, I was wondering why I did not see people that I know should have been in that Zoom room to at least greet our sister. Come to find out, somebody sent out the wrong call-in number. Wow. Yep, they sure did. Created a new flyer and then put the wrong information on it. So, you know. But anyway, it was an incredible conversation. It was good to see Sister Ramona. She's looking so much better after battling an illness. And again, today marks the 38th year of a bomb being dropped here in Philadelphia, killing 11 people, 5 of them children. And so, of course, we talked about it last night with Sister Ramona, who is the only surviving adult. Well, excuse me, she's the only survivor, period, now. There was 2 survivors from the initial 1985 bombing. Sister Ramona was the only adult, and there was a child whose name was Birdie. He has now also made transition. So we did talk with Sister Ramona. Also joined us last night was Sister Janine and Sister Janet Africa, and also Brother Eddie Africa. So it was, again, a very powerful conversation, to say the least. And it gave a lot of clarity to what really happened. Not what you heard, but from Ramona's own mouth, what happened. And I'm telling you, it was chilling to hear some of what she shared, including the fact that as they tried to come out of the burning house, the bullets that the police was, and she said that the police reported in later reports that it was roughly at least 10,000 bullets
rounds that was shot into them. So, you know, we'll tell you more about that as well a little later on, but I think Baba Oduno is in queue. I think I see him. And so, again, who knows about the great Nanny Helen Burroughs? Well, I'm going to tell you, this is one of the reasons why I really love and appreciate my elders, because I wasn't really that, I didn't know that much about her, years ago. It's from elders like who you're going to hear right now that really, you know, helped me to become more familiar with her. And since then, I've taken the time to do more studying and research. But again, it took one of the elders to kind of say, you know, and it piqued my interest because I'd heard, but I really had not taken the time to research her. And let me tell you, I'm so glad that I did. So without further ado, let's bring in Baba Oduno, and he is going to share with us some information, insight into the great Nanny Helen Burroughs. And note, next week we'll be talking really more extensively. I'm hoping to have two people on who really have done extensive research. We didn't have time to kind of get with them for tonight. But as I said, Baba Oduno is just excellent. You're going to love what he will share with us for tonight. It won't be the extension or the extended version that will come. And so, interestingly enough, the great Nanny Helen Burroughs was born in the month of May and also made transition in the month of May. So this week commemorated her born day, her Earth Day, and the next conversation we will be commemorating her as an ancestor. So let's go to that live line and let's talk with Baba Oduno, and he is going to share with us some, just some insight and history of the legacy and the great work of Nanny Helen Burroughs. Hey, Baba, how you do tonight?
Hey, Queen T, giving a shout out to your audience. I know I'm going to be succinct and move forward, but I would just like to say right quickly that Queen Maria Stewart was an institutional builder. Anna Julia Cooper was an institutional builder. And Ida B. Wells was an institutional builder. There are too many of us who are familiar with Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman. Those were also institutional builders, but tonight we're going to share with you an institutional builder, what you think or thought you knew about other institutional builders who built their own institutions for women and girls. I don't know how many people are on the line, but I want you to chime in with me in your own way and an opening thought on the person, her views, and her legacy. Nanny Helen Burroughs would help us with sow a thought and reap a deed. Sow a deed and reap a character. Sow a character and reap a destiny. Now, some of you all were getting on a little bit late, so may I say that over again. Sow a thought. This is by Nanny Helen Burroughs, the principal of the National and the Professional School for Women and Girls, which was established in 1909 all the way up through 2013. She practiced this. Sow a thought and reap a deed. Sow a deed and reap a character. Sow a character and reap a destiny. Nanny Helen Burroughs didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about herself, her mother, her father. For those of you who are research-minded, there's a book that's called The Dream and the Dreamer Reverend Harrison, which was produced in 1955 and 1972 copy. But I would just like to say to you that this institutional building. See, when I talk about women, Baba Oduno Tariq, I talk about the women who built the institutions. You know, your big mama, your big sister acted like she was a big mama, especially if she was maybe a year and 9 months older. I don't know if you all got that kind of experience, but that's what happened in my experience in Beaumont, Texas, when my mother, even my mother was in the house. But anyway, when we look at Nannie Helen Burroughs, just briefly, the setting was that she was born and reared in Orange County, Virginia. And her mother, Mother Fanny, was wise enough to, when she was 5 years of age, because she was born what we call the 2nd of May in 1879. And so you folks out there who born in 1979 and you got some grandchildren born in 1979, you graduate from school in 1979, I'm talking about elementary school or wherever you graduated, that's 143 years ago. And so she, for whatever reason, she's lesser known than the works that she performed here on earth. What do I mean? I would just like to say to you that Nannie has taught us we are beholding to the past long, that we are not shaping the present and we are responsible to the future. This was in New Jersey at the Beaumont County Business and Professional Women's Council in 1950. And the beautiful thing about Nannie Helen Burroughs, she attended school here in the nation's capital. We prefer to call it Banneker City, Anacostia. Won't go into those details. But she graduated from the M Street School in 1896. And can you imagine having people like your teachers, like Mary Church Terrell? I'm not going to go into the details. Somebody else may go into the details. She had like Anna Julia Cooper, one of her books, The Woman's Voice from the South. She had Carter Godwin Woodson. She had the Grimke sisters. And let me move on to say that when Nannie Helen Burroughs was in school, she wasn't like some of us last 50, 40, 10 years or so sophisticated. I'm not going to major in no domestic science. Negro, shut up and sit down. That's home economics. Okay? Now, she also majored in the classics. So she had a double major getting out of the M Street School May of 1896. What happened in 1896? Most of us have a tendency to think about Plessy versus Ferguson. That's right. Okay. But of the defeat of the Italians at the Battle of Adwa, March of 1896. Let me move on ahead, okay? Nannie Helen Burroughs thought that she would be called back, have a tutelage at her high school. It didn't happen. There was rumor that because, we have melanated men and women and melanated. We got the highly melanated, the medium melanated, and the lower melanated. And if somebody in my listening audience may not fully comprehend melanated, I shouldn't use it, meaning that complexion from teeth and tan to brown to dark brown to midnight black. And so she left here and worked as a secretary for the Baptist entity, interesting enough, initially in Philadelphia, okay, in the whole 1899. She was there for a year, and she went to Kentucky. That's where she got her start in reference to planning to have a school in the nation's capital, because she believed that God told her that she was supposed to have a school on a hill in Washington, D.C., and that on that hill, it was supposed to be 6 acres of land. So she had a call. She put together a plan. She got the exposure. So when she was in Kentucky, not only did she work for the Baptist Publishing House there, She also had a Saturday school teaching women domestic sciences, teaching women the business sciences, because remember, in 1896 was about the same time that the club women, seven different club women, the Afro-American colored women, club women, the colored women club, they came together in Northwest Washington, D.C., at Shiloh Baptist Church and established the Colored Club Women Association. So Nanny Ellen Burroughs spent so much time in that particular place. Now, in 1900, she got on the scale that was not only local, but it was national. And she was only 21 years of age. She spoke at a men's conference. Actually, it was a Baptist conference of men and women, but you would have thought that it was only a men's conference. I don't know how Nanny Ellen Burroughs got the opportunity to present there, but the title of her presentation was Why the Sisters Are Hindered from Helping. And she went on and the thing, she said, we are not called to be prancing around raising money, and you are the ones who are doing the speaking and the planning. And somebody said to Nanny Ellen Burroughs, you sound like a starter. She said, I may be a startup, but I've already started. And so as we go from that 1900, and if we look and see that at the same time in 1900, Margaret Murray Washington was assisting her husband, Booker T. Washington, to formulate the NNBL. That's the National Negro Business League. Now, some of you all out in the listening audience, well, what does this have to do with Nanny Ellen Burroughs? Nanny Ellen Burroughs was always an institutional builder for women to be business women from their home. We thought that we got something new in the last 20, 30, or 40 years. And so this is what she was involved in. How was she involved in that? She was involved in that because she was a member of the Colored Women Association. She still had the vision, and she worked the vision from Kentucky, but then she got the opportunity to come back to Washington, D.C., formally in 1906, 1907, and she spoke to the men of the National Baptist Incorporated. Would they assist her with having a school for women and girls in the nation's capital? They said, oh, no, why don't you do like Mary McLeod Bethune in Daytona Beach out in the countryside? Why don't you do like Booker T. Washington in the countryside of Tuskegee? She didn't say too much. She said, thank you. Then she came back another time with six women. 3 months later, they said, will you all help us to buy some property or put the money down on the property? And she had been looking around Washington, D.C., and she found a piece of property on a hill in Lincoln Heights in Washington, D.C. And she went back to the men and said, would you all agree with us to buy property? The men said, oh, sure, as long as you have the money. You know how women of promise, women of vision, they already had the $6,000 that they needed for the 6 acres of land. Now, for you country folks who forgot what an acre is, and for you city folks who know what it is or forgot what it is, an acre is roughly sitting inside a football field. So they purchased 6 acres of land in between 1907 and 1909 to set up a school that's called the National and the Professional School for Women and Girls. They taught the craft trades that normally were taught to women, and they taught the trades that were to men in terms of barbering, in terms of gardening, in terms of printing. And the beautiful thing about it is that, because I'm a basketball player, They also, 2 years later, because the women had encouraged the playing of movement, they actually had a basketball team. And why do I say this? If you're listening, Nannie Helen Burroughs was known as the woman of the Bible, the bathtub, and the broom. And I don't know when I'm supposed to bring this helicopter on in, but she said, the Bible is good word direction. The bathtub is water. She didn't say this, but I kind of give a grilled version of it. It's for keeping your hind pots or your behind clean. And the broom is for keeping your home and around your house clean. Nannie Helen Burroughs was so profound that she helped to set up the Women's Auxiliary of the National Baptist. I'm going back a little bit in 1902, and she was the national secretary for nearly 39 years. And what did this school do? Just as you know, a private ebony, so-called colored or Negro schools that was used at that particular point in time, she was able to train up women and girls at the same time. And Nannie Helen Burroughs had some sayings. She said, what must we do for ourselves? One, we should teach our children. I hope you got your pen and pad, y'all. Some of y'all think you can just listen and remember. That's okay. I know all of you all don't have no photographic memory that some people think I have. I got a decent memory. She said, one, we should teach, this is in the school, the national and the professional school for women and girls. We're not talking about an individual woman. We're talking about an institutional builder who worked with other institutional builder as well as working with families. Yes, she worked with individual women and girls. One, we should teach our children to put first things first. The first things are good character. The next thing is to learn a trade, to have a good education. And the next thing is to position yourself to buy a piece of property so you can take care of yourself and take care of your family.
There's
12 of them. Yeah. But I'll just read two more. And two, we should teach our children not to expect things to be given to them, to understand the value of work and taking personal responsibility and accountability for things that can do for themselves. You know how some people say, I got a right, I got a right? Wait a minute.
Yes,
you do have a right. Yes, I do have a right. But what about your responsibility in this age and the age to come? Three, she said, we should teach our children to keep themselves and their surroundings clean and attractive. You see why she was, three of her codes was the Bible, the bathtub, and the broom. And for those of us out in your listening audience, I hope you have a spiritual book or a spiritual system. And even if you may not have one explicitly, we cannot get around the bathtub and the broom. Keeping our surroundings and attractive. How Dr. Francis Chris Wilson, almost 40 years later, teaching us that and a number of other things. So our wonderful listening audience, we who are here in Washington, D.C., we're not doing sufficiently based on what these women and girls have done. Nannie Helen Burroughs was with Mary McLeod. She was with some of her teachers. Because when you talk about somebody like Anna Judy Cooper, she lived all the way from 1854 to 1964. Mary Church Terrell lived up until 1954. Mary McLeod Bethune lived from 1875 from South Carolina to 1955. So if you haven't heard of the woman Nanny Helen Burrow, I will suggest to you, as I came on speaking to you about her, she is an institutional builder who would sow a thought and reap a deed. Sow a deed and reap a character. And sow a character and reap a destiny. And I'm not just theoretically talking about Nanny Helen Burrows in 2009. Excuse the first person singular for Baba Oduno. I was one of the science judges for the science fair at the Nanny Helen Burrows School. And if you want, excuse the first person singular again, some of us heard about Nanny Helen Burrows when we grew up in Beaumont, Texas, when we were going to some of those so-called segregated schools. And we knew about the women who were builders. So my brothers and my sisters, when we look and see and talk about people, let's look and see how did they work with the institutional builders? How did they work with the families? How did they work with the women? How did they work with the boys, the men, and whomsoever else? Nanny Helen Burrows is such a general with a battalion plus. And in 1937, she became the president of the Women's Auxiliary National Baptist with 750,000 women on her shoulders. Thank you for allowing me the woman, the Bible, the bathtub, and the broom, the dream, and the dreamer who built the institution of, as we call it, the National and a professional school for women and girls, and that acreage of property is still in the hands of Africans here in this country that help to support Africans abroad. And at another time, hopefully we'll talk about how did Nanny Helen Burrows impact the Caribbean? How did she impact the United States? How did she impact the continent of Africa? How did she impact Haiti? How did she impact India? Thank you very much for allowing me to share, because when we raise up women and women institutional builders, we're raising up our families. Thank you very much. One God, one aim, one destiny. Africa for the Africans. Those who are for Nanny Helen Burrows, say amen. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Baba Oduno. Listen, family, I hope you were taking some notes, and if not, it's okay, because we're going to do part two next week, and we're going to, what Baba just said, we're going to go more into some of the influences. But you have to ask, Baba, if you have a few more minutes, I'm going to ask our listening audience family if they have any questions or comments, and if you do, you can press one. How about that?
Is
that okay? Okay, great.
I'm woke now.
All right. All right. So, family, listen, if you have a question or a comment, please feel free to press one now. And we still have Baba with us. And, again, it is on us to make certain that we educate our own people, our children, one another, each one teach one. So with that said, if you have a question or a comment, you can press one, and we certainly would bring you into the conversation. In the meantime, Baba, in your opinion, and I kind of know the answer to this, but in your opinion, why do you think we don't hear much about Nanny Helen Burrows? Why is that? I mean, we hear about other great educators, you mentioned a couple of that we hear a little more of than we do of her. Why is it we don't hear much about her?
Some of us remember, and I'm going to use a Philadelphia giant, Robeson, right?
Mm-hmm.
A large segment of people in certain religious ways of life, they decided to a quiet campaign about her, okay?
Right.
Like a silent campaign, right? You know,
right,
how they kind of like erased that Paul Robeson was ever an All-American, and a number of other things. And those of us, if we weren't digging about or in theatrical or in sports, we may not have heard about him. But the major reason that was a comical thing that was made when she departed, they said they would listen to Nanny Helen Burroughs. They would agree with Nanny Helen Burroughs, but then they would go home and do nothing. Because, you see, Nanny Helen Burroughs was not a person who was a pulpiteer, just an elocutionist as a she came up not the slick side of the mountain. Because she said, if you try to come up the slick side of the mountain, you're going to slide back down. She came up the rough side of the mountain. And because her skills and tools in terms of her ability, but there were some men who were part of the National Baptist Convention and some other Baptist convention when she passed in 1961, right?
Right.
It was said that they didn't go there to wish her well based on what she and 750,000 women had been doing and did, right? They went to see whether she was actually dead. And there were people who were humor. There was a brother who also told me that he's about 92 years of age. He was not in that particular group of people in the National Baptist. And so what happens is that it's almost like people in my generation, and they don't like for me to say this, but I kicked their assets all the way to the Hoover Dam, on the way to the Cotabato Dam in Mozambique, up the Rift Valley to the dam in Egypt. Too many people in my generation, when I'm talking about my generation, y'all, I'm talking about people who are 70. Well, actually, we are closer to 80 than we are to 70, okay, and older.
Yep, right.
What happened is that too often, too many of us do not want to demonstrate who were the trailblazers, only the popular men and a few of the popular women, but who were the trailblazers. And too often, men, and unfortunately women too often, following men in the inappropriate direction, they talk or saw a set, but yet they practice domination that is alien even to our environment of enslavement here in this Western hemisphere of it kind of reminds me, even though she had another kind of a call, Ella Little Collins, one of the Littles, most people say Malcolm, right? Ella Collins out of Georgia, who spent a considerable amount of time. She gets some, but she's closer to the modern era. That's what, because too often when people talk, especially when people are talking about Malcolm, you don't get people to readily talk about the woman, his sister, not half sister, his
right.
sister, who brought him in. People are real quiet on those kind of women, and she was an institutional builder in her own right. And I'll say, excuse the first person singular, we were finally able to get her here, October of 1986, along with Imam Jamil Al-Amin, okay, for Community Day through the Our Own History Club. Ella didn't cut no punches. You feel me? Ella Little Collins, the one that people know, and people kind of like, because people, I'm talking about, and I'm not talking about, and I'm not talking about the Big Six, okay? And I'm going to call no names. Because Malcolm sufficiently unpacked again. Matter of fact, Ella Baker unpacked that. Okay, and so what have is that we have to dig a little bit deeper for the platinum, the palladium, the gold, the silver, and the bronze with incense. And I'm talking about this is an institution to go find me a city.
Mm-hmm.
Where men got together, where women got together, and happened to still have the purview over, as a matter of fact, it's more than 6 acres there now. And because we're in a reshuffle where we are looking at reestablishing the visibility of the 200 so-called safe spaces, which was not space, because if you don't have a defense, your space is not safe. They're going the powers that be are those who work with the powers that be that look like us. And so it's a and plus in the nation's capital. I mean, it's as far as I'm concerned, not just humanistic. But if you look at the number and she worked more predominantly in a melanated enclave, but she did interaction with other nationalities, especially in reference to women, but it was always from the purpose of having your power base. No, we ain't going over there integrating with someone. We are in our own right, and that's kind of it. And she was a part of the long before what we call women having the right to vote. Okay, with those other women, if people look at the people who she came under, just in high school, at the M Street School for Coloreds here in Washington D.C.
All right. So next week, Bob, thank you as always. You always bring so much great information to us and enlightenment. And so next week, family, we are going to kind of do a part two and really go a little deeper. We're going to have a little more time, I think, to do that as well. And we're going to invite a couple of other folks on to join us, because we really think that it's our responsibility to bring a certain type of information. Note, one of the things that that we advocate with MWM is our own schools. We started off with that 2 decades ago. That was a part of our platform issues. So when people start talking about schools today, that they're going to build schools today, and we said it then. Unfortunately, we could not get the support and haven't been able to do that again for 2 decades to get the kind of support. And no, what Baba shared with us today is what? Here we had a sister. What was the number of membership again, Baba, that Nanny Ellen Burroughs, St. Nanny Ellen Burroughs was able to get?
As of 1937, when she became president, she had 750,000 women on her shoulders as a president, not only here in the United States, but in Central and South America. In West Africa, in East Africa, and definitely in South Africa. And I would just like to say, and people don't like for me to say this, the independent black schools here in Washington, D.C., they perhaps have it in their curriculum, because I have never observed a program for the national and the professional school, because remember, and she taught the subject that Carter G. Woodson taught, because she was on the board at the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. And the independent school, see, a lot of times we be looking at what the Big Six is not doing. What are we who purport to be not a part of the Big Six? And we're supposed to be about accept your own and be yourself. And so just because you've had 60 years of some dribbles of independent black schools, right? We have a responsibility and our respect. It's like when I think of Philadelphia, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think of Edward. I think of Dr. Edward Boucher, who was a physicist, who graduated in 1876 from Yale University, but he taught at the Philadelphia Colored High School for about 21 years, right? Because he couldn't get the hire. He couldn't get. This is a man in physics with a PhD, and we sitting here lying and passing a lie on that somebody from the NAACP, I'm not going to call no name, that they were the first who to have a PhD, and he didn't complete his PhD until 1895, and he completed, I've already given it away, his master's degree in 1884, and he was a little bit earlier at Fisk, you know what I mean? The lies, mm-hmm. I'm not throwing any rocks there, but you see, when you run with Oscar Nazis, and when you run with Fabian socialists, and when you run with people who look like us, who want to be other people, they will come to steal, destroy at any and all costs through their propaganda.
Okay. All right.
I'm not beholding to folks who, as Carter G. Woodson called them, the traducers of the race. Yeah, that's what he meant, enemies, but he wrote it sophisticatedly. I'm going to go on and get me some rest.
All right, brother. Well, listen, again, we thank you.
Oh, I got to get that. I got to get that number to you, too.
Oh, yes. Yeah, because you want to definitely put them on for next week.
Yeah, I got to get Colonel's number. What I'll do, send the platform that I should text it to you on, okay?
All right, Baba. Thank you so much.
Okay.
And family, we will continue this dialogue next week because you need to know more about Nanny Helen Burroughs. All right, Baba. Asante Sana, thank you again, and look forward to talking with you next week.
Asante Sana.
Sekichu. All right, y'all. You heard it right here. So now, here we are in 2023. Are you telling me that black women can't do what our women already showed us that we could do? That's why we're getting ready to do the Million Woman World March. Because we know we can get at least a million sisters of African descent worldwide to come together. We believe we can get more than that, but we want a solid million to at least be able to move the way we need to move collectively. And we can, and we must. So again, tomorrow night and Monday night, we're going to begin organizing those who are interested in being a part of any of the task forces or the action teams tomorrow night. And Monday, 9 o'clock, we will begin to formulate the next steps of those committees that are now going to move forward in our communities nationwide throughout the U.S. Well, we've already really started building with Sisters in Africa, by the way. In fact, big shout out to Sister Rahima last night joined us from the Gambia when we did our discussion with Sister Ramona. And, of course, we've been talking with sisters from Cameroon, Ghana, Nigeria, Congo, et cetera, because we know it's time for this global movement to come forward. So stay tuned, y'all. So, listen, I'm checking to see, see Sister Sheila Brown in queue. Sister Sheila, if you can hear me, press 1 so that I can see that you are in queue. Because I'm not seeing. Oh, okay. I see you now. Great, great, great. All right. All right, family. So listen. Again, today is the anniversary, or shall I say the day to remember that 11 people were murdered here in Philadelphia. Unfortunately, for some of us, Mother's Day is kind of a strange time because it was, in fact, on Mother's Day, 1985, May 13, really came on Mother's Day, literally. At any rate, MWM is on a serious mission, and that mission is to deal with the issue of human rights for our people. In July, there's going to be a whole weekend to commemorate the work of St. Callie House, St. Queen Mother Moore, and others, but certainly to present the platform in a more extensive manner of the We Charge Genocide 21. What is it? Why is it? What is the focus, the mission that is presently and in the future? What are the 21 points? What are the action plans for those 21 points of crimes against humanity? Now, we're going to bring Sister Sheila in because she not only is an attorney in her own right, and no, not one of these system attorneys. I mean, she is licensed and all that. But we are developing attorneys like the great Alton Maddox, our attorneys at war, and also Chukwe Lumumba. And so we're going to be developing cadres that study their work, bring some of their work forward. Remember, Chukwe Lumumba was one of the members and maybe even founding member of the Republic of New Africa, and definitely one of the organizations in Jackson, the African People's Movement, I think it was called, before he became mayor of Jackson. But he was a freedom fighter all the way through. So we are making certain that the people that we now connect with have that kind of tenacity and focus. So let's open up our live line. And even though, again, Sister Sheila wears a whole lot of hats like me, tonight we're going to focus on her recent trip to Geneva, Switzerland. What that was about, why it was about, and what can we gain from it, or what can we now look at as a result of being able to hear, listen, interact. So we're going to bring Sister Sheila in to get that report and to help us, again, navigate into some of the next steps of obtaining not just our human rights, inalienable rights, too, which we'll talk about a little later on because that's even a little deeper. But for now, we'll keep it at human rights. So let's talk to our Sister Sheila Brown in the house. Hey, Sister Sheila, how are you this evening?
Peace and blessings, Queen. I'm doing wonderful. How are you this evening?
Oh, you know. It was a full day like you, full evening. But, you know, it's such a wonderful thing to be with our people. And particularly the ones who are really trying to, and not just trying, but many of them already are, literally doing things to help our people advance. So I'm going to turn the mic over to you. I thank you for being patient. I didn't want to rush Baba. You know, I tend to, you know, let the elders do what they need to do. And he had a little difficult time getting on initially as well. But I'm going to turn the mic over to you, and please share with us what this past week has been like, not since your return, but, you know, while you were there. Tell us what that was about.
Well, it was a very ancestral experience for me. I didn't think that it would be that way, being in Geneva, Switzerland, of all places, but I realized that the work that I do around Queen Mother Amy Jakes Garvey was the calling that would propel me to go there and to go there with a mission of invoking for the newer minds, the younger minds, and the elders even, who were there advocating on behalf of African people using the tools of the United Nations and the European powers that back it to provide some advocacy for people of African descent. And what, as a background, I think is important to note is that where I went was the United Nations headquarters for what is referred to as an event known as the 32nd session of the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. Now, this is important. This took place from May 1st through May 5th of this month in Geneva, Switzerland, at the United Nations headquarters, where dozens of people convened on the United Nations headquarters, plus countless more online, to talk about systemic racism and global economic structures that operate through financial mechanisms which impact or affect the economic and financial empowerment of people of African descent, with the objective of tracing the trajectories and the impacts of slavery, colonization, segregation, and apartheid over the last 4 to 5 centuries. Panelists were selected from all over the world, not all of them actually people of African descent, I believe. And it should be noted that at least one of the 5 experts is not a woman of African descent. That is an interesting piece to note as well. She's actually an Asian from Bangladesh who has a lot to say about the work that we are trying to do to proliferate the issues and bring awareness to, I suppose, the people who are in a position they think to make a difference. And so I went there with all of these questions about what to expect, what my role would be, who would I encounter, were they real grassroots activists, were they, you know, counterfeit human rights activists operating under some other agenda, maybe, you know, no disrespect, LGBTQI, or maybe, you know, general human rights for all people of color. I just didn't know what to expect. And to be honest, it was a little bit of everything. But what it was clear to me is that those of us who are really interested in doing this divine work of liberation for our people, we have to get into uncomfortable spaces with uncomfortable and sometimes unfamiliar and sometimes opposing forces in order to understand what they are doing in our names for our future. Even if we don't see that future, our grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren will have to contend with the decisions that are being made by a very select few group of people, many of whom who have our best interests, but not always having access to us to be able to represent a duly elected, certified group of people like most nations and nation states have the opportunity to do. So we have some challenges before us, but what was encouraging was the effort that was put into place by people who are not of African descent, who operate under the auspices of the United Nations, to really, as I glean it, kind of mimic the work that was done over 100 years ago, when Queen Mother Amy Euphemia Jakes Garvey and her king, the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey, had undertaken the work for themselves under the spirit of self-determination. And that is where it became crystal clear for me why the ancestors sent me, a little girl from out of Maryland who never left the country since she was about 4 or 5 years old, to do anything, especially in Europe. It became crystal clear because all the work that I had done up to this point as a student of the Honorable Amy Euphemia Jakes Garvey had been prepping me to continue the work that she had already started back in 1944 when she was commissioned by another elder to summarize what she referred to as her memorandum into one summary called the Memorandum Correlative, where she laid out a complete declaration of issues and potential solutions and demands on behalf of her people to present to the League of Nations. So this was really, really interesting for me once I started to put together the ancestral pieces. right? And so the topic was relevant, and because I am a part of the International Civil Society Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent, which is another mouthful, a non-governmental organization that is not related directly to the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. So we've got to get this lingo down because that's important, right? So there's the Working Group of Experts consisting of five people, ironically not a single African male of any ethnic group was on that. It consists ironically of four African women of African descent and one Asian. So I want you to kind of visualize what that represents. The future is not the divine patriarch. Forgive the term if you are offended by the term patriarch. They're not even a part of the working group. But the sisters that I did hear were sincere, intelligent, and courageous. Okay, so let's start there. So the topic, again, that we were deliberating, if you will, was about the financial empowerment of people of African descent and things that have been operating for the last 400 or 500 years to prevent that from occurring at its highest potential and what the anticipated future trends would look like. And so this is an opportunity for me to invoke on my first opportunity to provide what's known as an intervention, which is where you can either make an observation, share an issue, an insight, and even make a recommendation to the working group. Well, I had the opportunity to do so, and I took every opportunity that I could because I knew the ancestors didn't send me all the way over to Europe to sit there and try and just look and observe without making a contribution, knowing what I know. And so because we had what we call a side event at the UN a couple of days before this kicked off, where we had put together a hypothetical context, and yours truly, for the listening audience, yours truly, our current blog host, who is Queen Mother in every right and every way, Empress Chi, was invited to be a panelist and provided some very powerful insights about what would happen and what we should do in the event that our efforts were successful in achieving reparatory justice or reparations in not just a monetary amount, which we used $45 trillion, but also in other assets and resources. And so our panelists had an opportunity to weigh in on what should that look like, what mechanisms and tools should we consider employing to make sure that we are able to preserve generational wealth once this has been achieved. And because the first session was kind of talking about this topic of reparations and trade routes from slavery on forward and how to transform that reality into something useful, which of course evoked for me the Black Star Line of the UNIA, and everything I talked about was related to the work our ancestors had already done with their own African government in mind. But particularly two of our panelists, one of which is I'm speaking to right now, Empress Chi, I was able to invoke her work as not just a founder of the Million Woman World March, but also someone who has some powerful insights about how to maneuver around generational wealth protection and preservation and proliferation, including her black print, which is a very, very creative way to undermine blueprint, but the black print agenda 2025, is it 2025?
It's 2025.
Okay. And so, we'll have to have a discussion about what all that entails. But I spoke about the five or the four R's that Empress Qi likes to evoke when she's talking about reparations, which include not only reparations, but restorations, not only retribution, but what was the fourth one? You gotta remind me. I'm so sorry. It's late.
Reparations, restitution.
Mm-hmm. So it's reparations, restitution, retribution, and restoration.
Write that right there. So, you know, people's jaws were dropping as I'm relaying, you know, these powerful insights. And I also have to give credit to Reverend Ambassador Brother Kamau, who talked about a very important thing that linked directly to this issue of sanctuary cities, which I thought brilliantly fit into the conversation because his sanctuary cities evokes this kind of reversal in my mind of the slave trade routes where once we were being brought here in bondage to serve, but we as a people need to reintroduce ourselves to each other as people of African descent on the continent and throughout the diaspora so that we can have a place to rebuild and reintroduce ourselves and create safe places for us through the African elders on the continent who can provide the context, the guidance, and the rules, so to speak, for providing this village at initial level turned nation at a more macro level. So I know I'm using a lot of terms and a lot of things, but I'm trying to paint a picture. So along these days, the way these sessions worked out was in the morning we had what was known as the morning session, which was unfortunately for us only 2 hours. So we would often have to squeeze in 4 to 5 to sometimes even 8 to 10 panelists. And then we have a hierarchy of recommendations and comments and conclusions. And that would always start with the working group itself. And then it would go to the nation states. So the United States presented itself, ironically, on day two, but it didn't speak until day three. And then South Africa, another European face who had a lot to say about people of African descent. And let me tell you this, it was very interesting because these people had figured out very cleverly how to shut the masses down. And it's simply to point out a few instances of egregious racism and be like, yeah, we did that right there. Isn't that terrible, right? And so, you know, people are like confused because before they would never acknowledge it, but then it would just stop. It would just like leave you on a cliffhanger, so there's nothing else to be said. Like, and so you're like, okay, you're saying that, but what, right? So it's like South Africa will say, you know, it's racism that's the problem. Racism is the problem. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. People think that if you can just hurt other people, that's okay. That's the problem. Racism is our problem for people of African descent. And you're just like, yeah, we figured that out a long time ago. But what are you here for again? So that was kind of like the formula. It is to simply acknowledge the egregious racism, but not take any ownership for it and almost position yourself as though you are one of the oppressed. This is very strange. So the South African state had very little love for me. And I'm okay with that, but it was just interesting, and I wanted to know that. Then after the nation states, the NGOs get to make their comments. So it was quite a few times during the sessions, morning and afternoon, and we had, I felt like, an unnecessarily long lunch break because, again, in my opinion, my humble opinion, if you've got this many people coming from this many places around the world, we should have been bringing our tents and sleeping bags in there as many problems that we have. I mean, God, if you could hear the side event that the brothers and sisters from Guyana were bringing, you would feel like, good Lord, listen to whole a group of Africans over there to put some stuff in place. They are in trouble and they are struggling, and their oppressor takes on the face of the Asian, the Indian, who has stepped into the shoes of the former Europeans who were once holding the whiplash, and they have just taken over the same mentality, and they have worse than almost enslaved. It's like a form of gaslighting enslavement where you never refer to your oppressed as slaves, but they have no rights. They have no access to the nation's resources, and they have no protections. You know, the Guyanese attorney, Nigel, I think his last name is Walker, a very unique individual for his expertise as a corporate attorney who deals with very high-profile cases and things like my law firm does, and, you know, talks about oil and gas and all these high-profile business transactions. But he has this dual side of him that deals with human rights, and he advocates fiercely and ferociously on behalf of his people. And he's a very unique, you know, person for that. And he was sharing, you know, how there was an incident recently where two young Guyanese young men were basically abducted, kidnapped. And by the time they were found, the only thing that connected them was the obvious look between the heads that were decapitated and the body. Now, we're not talking about the Ku Klux Klan. We're talking about Bangladeshi kind of people, you know, like whoever the Indian nations that are running this thing are vicious and wicked and violent in ways that are evoking the 1920s for people of African descent in the United States coming back from World War I, where they are now, after saving the world, faced with segregation, Jim Crow, lynchings in uniforms, and all of the workings that come along with trying to destabilize a group that is starting to recognize that the world is not as small as you have tried to paint it to be. And so when you hear these stories, it reminded me again of what was happening in 1920 when the Universal Negro Improvement Association convened in Madison Square Garden in New York with some, 20,000 people of African descent coming together for the first time to share their collective and individual nation state woes, complaints, grievances, and hear proposed recommendations and solutions, something that they were doing on their own. And out of that came, now this is notable because this is where I really realized that I had a divine purpose there. And it was the last day, and I really thought I was never going to get this opportunity to make a statement. But the last 2 days before the final day on Friday, everybody kept evoking this document that was established officially as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a document that began its drafting in 1947 under the direction of Eleanor Roosevelt, with 9 individuals, not a single one of which was a person of African descent. Now, note, that is just 7 years after the passing of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey. Now, we know Eleanor Roosevelt has an indirect link to the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey through her husband, Theodore Roosevelt, who was instrumental in his release from prison in 1927. So we got to pay attention to these dates and names. So my premise in the comment that I made was that I know you guys are holding on with life and limb. I didn't say that, but that was my preface in the unstated part, to this Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But are you aware that our ancestors, after fighting in World War I and defending democracy and the right for self-determination, when our soldiers returned home and they were facing intensified discrimination in ways that they hadn't even seen prior to the war, that out of this frustration, the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey was able to attract thousands of these disillusioned Black working class, lower middle class followers to his UNIA convention. And these brilliant, committed, self-determined Black people started not only the Black Star Line business at Liberty Hall, bringing together 25,000 UNIA delegates from around the world, and gave to us something so powerful and so relevant to today, because when I read the preamble and the 12 complaints and the 54 articles, you think I'm just reading some brilliant document that, you know, maybe what Black Lives Matter and the UNIA would come together and produce for today's issues. And that is the Declaration of Rights of the Negro Peoples of the World. You know, the people there, even though I didn't think I was saying anything especially unique, they had never heard of it before. Well, when I finished making the statement, Chairwoman Barbara Reynolds, who is a very interesting woman as far as I'm concerned and a very sincere sister, because on the very first day she invoked the name Mumia Abu-Jamal and even Emmett Till in her initial opening comment. Okay. So she got my attention right there, as someone that we could really be paying attention to. So she made a comment that we did not know this. We're thankful for it. And one of the reasons she said that is because I was making the connection for them, not only introducing them to the fact that 100 and some odd years ago, our people had already done this work themselves without the help of the UN, but specifically left some instructive guidance. And then I'm going to go, because I know we don't have all night to discuss this. But what was most notable of all of the discussions that I had and all of the interventions and recommendations that I made was pointing their attention to three of the articles, the first of which I just felt the need to share as it is historic and important, which is that the UNIA in this declaration declared that the colors, red, black, and green, be the colors of the race. That was our intelligent 25,000 ancestors from around the African globe decided that for us. Then I pointed their attention to article number 45. Now, this is important and it's very instructive, especially because of where we were. And this is what the ancestors really wanted these five, or at least four of them, to know. They said, be it further resolved that we as a race of people declare the League of Nations null and void as far as the Negro is concerned, in that it deprives the Negroes of their liberty. What? So if you are feeling frustration that the efforts that you are making, like when you, as an expert working group, challenged the report that came out by the UK government where the Prime Minister Boris Johnson expressed gratitude for this report that literally supported and rationalize white supremacy using the same familiar arguments that have always been used to justify racial hierarchy and made its attempt to normalize white supremacy. This is the statement of the working group of experts about this report that was issued just a few years ago, in which the UN experts came to the conclusion that there really is no longer any systemic racism impacting people of African descent. Now, it's also ironic that the person who pushed this forward was a commission member by the name of Samir Shah. Can you catch this? Mm-hmm. An Indian man who is a commission member of the UK Parliament was the one who said that institutional racism no longer exists in Britain. How ironic is this? Mm-hmm. Now, the five members of the Human Rights Working Group, they released a statement in 2021 when this issue first arose, and they said that we rebuke, for lack of a better word I'm using for them, that the publication blamed single parents for the poor outcomes of people of African descent, that racism was a product of the imagination of people of African descent, or it was simply discrete, individualized incidents. And that they claim you, with this report, are making an attempt to ignore the pervasive role that the social construction of race was designed to play in society. That group also accused the commission of openly blaming identity politics for issues around race in the UK. Now, this is the UK. And then it also pointed to its own study of the UK in 2012, which showed that the reality for Black folk or people of African descent in the country was the experience of their poor economic, social, and health disproportionate rates in the UK. And so it was just this tone-deaf attempt to reject the lived realities of people of African descent. And we should note that the working group pointed that out and advocated that this report be rejected by the UK government. Okay, so that's important. They wanted to have the UK reject the findings of the report and disband that commission that put it together. But much to their dismay, like our ancestors told them to anticipate, the purpose of this organization, the League of Nations, which we now know is the United Nations. It just rebranded itself and was closed in 1946, and it moved its headquarters and its new logo and new outfit into the United Nations, which is what is governing the working group today. So I say all this to not discourage people, but to simply connect the dots, as you would say, connect the black dots. And so, and the ancestor who said that, who gave you that, it's important for us to be very analytical and do the research and to be spiritually attuned to our ancestors, because every chance I go, I invoke the spiritual, intellectual gifts of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey and his comrade, confidant, political advisor, legal consultant, and wife, the Honorable Amy Euphemia Jakes Garvey. So much respect and gratitude to those two individuals who already gave us a heads up that we were in the presence of our enemies. According to the scriptures, thou hast prepared a table before me in the presence of my enemies. And so although Queen Mother Amy Euphemia Jakes Garvey recognized that because of the race traitors, the Blue Vein Society, which I also talked about during one of my interventions, the people who undermined the work of the Universal Negro Improvement Association in the 20s, they succeeded in preventing us from achieving the independent global African vision for a independent and united Africa, but at the same time now forced our brilliant and heartbroken ancestors to have to contend with and negotiate with these bodies operating under the UN. So if anyone has any questions, I'll be happy to do my best to answer them, but it was a powerful event, and that's the gist of what I want to share at least for tonight.
All right. Thank you so much, my sister and family. If you have a question or comment to the report that Sister Sheila just gave us, please press 1 now. And it's a wonderful thing to have you all to become more familiar with how some of this stuff actually operates. Most entities that I'm familiar with, they're not going to take the time, the energy, the effort for you to know and understand some of this stuff. And it's important that we do. Because as long as other people, and I'm talking about people amongst us, as long as they're the ones that are holding on to this information, and I'm using the word holding on because I just feel like being nice tonight, but the point is they keep the stuff amongst themselves, and then they maneuver with it in whatever way they can, and it ends up benefiting them and those that they want to have it to benefit, if there are benefits at all. And sometimes there are, y'all. Don't be fooled, and we'll go more into that at another time. But learning to maneuver in some of these areas definitely can bring about monetary advances, okay? It's just the reality of it. And this is why some stay in that arena and don't really connect with the masses of the people. They just don't. So, you know, we're very different in that regard because we have to represent our ancestors in every way possible. So let me ask again, if there's any questions or comments, you can press 1 now, and we certainly will allow you to share your thoughts. Okay? This is Sheila. Mm-hmm. Certainly what you shared made it very, well, I already knew, of course, but it just validated what we already knew. And this is what I've been telling people all along, that the game is rigged. It really is in many regards. However, there's always just a little possibility of something. And so knowing that, you know, we always have to look to see where that is, when that is, and so forth, because it does exist. It might not be as vast or as open as we would like, but it does exist. And so we have to be able to seize the time, as they say. But certainly, we've got to learn how to maneuver in the bigger scheme of things, because if not, we will be at the mercy, and I put that mildly, of others. And some of those others ain't going to look like us. Some of them will and some of them won't. Not that it's any different or any better, but in certain cases, in certain situations, the point is, though, if we do not begin to engage, we will have others representing us, and it's not going to be a good thing, bottom line.
You know, while we're waiting to see if anyone has a comment, the other article that I brought to their attention is the fact that our ancestors also made room for us to be present at these kinds of conferences. And they did that in Article 42, which states, "We demand that our duly accredited representatives, not the representatives that the UN hires, our accredited representatives, be given proper recognition in all leagues, conferences, conventions, or courts of international arbitration wherever human rights are discussed." So our ancestors weren't myopic. They weren't narrow-minded into thinking that they could just exist in their own little village mindset. They recognized that we were a part of the global universal world system and that we had better organize ourselves in a position of power with a power-based foundation in the continent of Africa, but we, our people all over the world, as it should be, making moves, setting up delegations, and organizing ourselves around commerce, culture, and customs. And so we had a plan, an action activity guide, a strategic approach to dealing with the global world powers. The Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey was an empire builder. He was not a village man. He did not see Black people eternally sitting around playing, don't disrespect, let me not say it disrespectfully, but he wanted the same things that we see now taking place in China and the United States and Russia. He wanted that for us. He knew that that was the only way to ensure our own freedom and our economic viability. So had he had his way, we would have our own nuclear warheads to be discussing at the table. We would have our own industries of commerce, our own access to commercial intercourse, as they put it. And what was also notable is that, I don't know if you're doing anything on this day, but our ancestors proclaimed the 31st day of August of each year to be an international holiday to be observed by all Negroes. So
yep.
It's something worth studying, and that is exactly what my recommendation was. And I think once I realized that I actually for the first time got almost short of a standing ovation, I was happy. And when most notably, when Barbara Reynolds, the chair of these experts of people of African descent, and can you imagine experts not knowing the complete and total categorical specific history of the UNIA, right?
Right.
And being able to call yourself an expert is very frightening to me, because all things self-governance and self-determined begins, as far as I'm concerned, and ends with the written history left for us by the Honorable Amy Euphemia Jakes Garvey through the UNIA's historic records as a guidepost for everything that had been done prior to its formation in 1914 by the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey and everything that we are experiencing today and will do so in the future. So prayerfully, and according to Barbara Reynolds, who was impressed with the statement, which I thought was not so impressive, but important to say, that because they are about to reconvene on the Durban Convention as a working group, that they would take my recommendation of studying the Declaration of Rights of the Negro Peoples of the World, incorporating it and even updating it, and including it in its analysis, if not in its final product. And that made me very happy, coupled with the fact that she said she would not only work with the Declaration of the Negro Rights of People of African Descent, but also would include me in the work. So that was something interesting. And when I finished that, I couldn't even just, I just left the room and I was like, I started texting everybody. I was like, oh my God, this is why I came here. This is what my singular purpose was here. Thank you, ancestors. I get it. I get it. Thank you for being born. Thank you for sending me here. Thank you, thank you, thank you for this opportunity, because I realized all of the delays had been saved for this singular moment. And so there were other opportunities, other notable conversations that I had. One was with the World Council of Churches, where I again got to evoke Mother Amy Euphemia Jakes Garvey when she reported about the issue of race and religion. And it was really funny and historic, but I was in a room full of white Christian leaders, and I took the opportunity to expound, and you can cut me off if I know we got to go, but I'll just share this last thing if there's time. Do we have it? 3 seconds
for
me to share this part? So they shared a story. I can remember, I think the theme was to point out egregious acts of racism committed by European global powers and their minions, right? And in this case, they were acknowledging that white missionaries were very problematic for people of African descent. And they used, again, something is going on in Guyana, they used the Guyanese rebellion that took place much in the same vein as the Honorable Nat Turner's rebellion here in the United States, where you had a Christian preacher, a pastor, a black man, a man of African descent, an African man, going to the white missionary who has been feeding him the good gospel of Christ, and him saying to him, listen, we want our rights, doing it the right way. Say, you know, you are the emissary of God, right? You're the messenger. You go back to the Europeans and tell them, we want our rights. And that man made a fatal decision. He said, just wait until Europe gives you your rights. Oh, and Brother Camino, oh, he said, oh, okay. All right, you have a good night, sir. You have yourself a restful night. And by the time those folks realized what happened, the spirit of Nat Turner, that same spirit had already done the work. And so, of course, he ended up being executed and the rebellion was squashed and, you know, things took a different turn. But these missionaries, these white missionaries were pointing that out. And I couldn't help but note the speech that I had memorized or from an article that Queen Mother Amy Euphemia Jakes Garvey had written, where she talked about the fact that white men in their arrogance believe that all beauty begins and ends with their race. And they take every endeavor to make others believe likewise. Their religious preachments reek of this propaganda when they paint a Christ as a white man surrounded by little white angels with white wings and take those pictures into foreign lands and tells black, yellow, and brown peoples about a white God sitting on a white throne. It is no wonder that Christianity has failed to impress Africans and Asiatics as it should, as they naturally argue that God could not be a good spiritual father to them, as he would naturally have the same double-dealing traits of the white missionaries who teach them to sing, "Take all the world, but give me Jesus," while these same messengers of God rob them of their minerals and lands. So I said, can you believe that she wrote this back in 1920? And they were just looking at me like, what did you just say out of your face? Oh, my goodness. So one of the missionary men, he just would stare at me the rest of the whole my troll trip. He would make eye contact with me. He would walk up to me, and then he would either greet the person in front of me, behind me, on the side of me, and he would just, like, he was glaring through me with red eyes. Like, he was so ticked off with me. And I was like, I'm just conveying what you all have conveyed. Like, I'm telling you that I know you're brilliant, but somebody else had already contemplated the fact that white missionaries were problematic for people of African descent. And she wrote an article about it, and here it goes, right? So, you know, it was those kinds of moments where I was like, okay, this is not a coincidence. This is divine. And that is the conclusion of that story I wanted to share.
Okay. Woo! That was, I mean, the report was great news to say, but the last part was really interesting. But yeah, I'm just so happy that we're able to connect this stuff now. Oh, my gosh. One quick question, and then we're going to head out. So what you read a little bit back there in terms of if the UN or whatever body it was did not have recognized black folks, that they should be, you know, kind of abolished or whatever. So who was that submitted to? And with that, was it actually accepted?
You're talking about the report that came out in 2012?
No. You read something that was from either the Honorable Marcus Garvey or I think it was from the Honorable Marcus Garvey.
You got Article 45, where he talked about the League of Nations being null and void as far as the Negro is concerned?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, what we do as NGOs and civil society working groups is we share issues that are impacting our communities. We make our observations, and then we also make recommendations. They call that an intervention. And so what is unusual about the response that I got, because usually they just move on to the next person, was besides the clapping of approval that I got from the audience, was the chairwoman, Barbara Reynolds, who is essentially the person responsible for coordinating this largely and managing the process, noted my comments and said, oh my goodness, basically, we did not know that. That is something very instructive, and we would like to make sure that we have this knowledge as we are moving forward with reconvening the working group to reestablish or update the Durban Conference Declaration on Racism or Against Racism.
Right. What I was referring to is that when it was written, was it submitted at that point? And if so, was it, you know, reviewed in any kind of way?
Oh, okay. So you're talking about the actual Declaration of the Negro Rights that was adopted by us in 1920?
Uh-huh. Was that ever submitted to either at some later point or whatever? Was that actually submitted to any entity, be it United Nations or some other similar type of structure?
I'm not sure. That's a really good question, but I know that the Negroes who were drafting it and proliferating it took it very seriously, and it was their, if you will, their most important declaration for the world, and so I'm sure it was published in the Negro World newspaper, most certainly. Mother Amy Euphemia Dix Garvey used it as a tool in Garvey and Garveyism and shared it through there. It's in Race First, written by Toni Martin. And so I'm almost confident that it was a guiding post for Eleanor Roosevelt, who used it, in my opinion, to create the watered-down version, removing all of the specific grievances and complaints, and definitely eliminating all of the declarations for or demands, but creating this universal document that hopefully would include people of African descent, but really just kind of spoke to this general body of wisdom, if you will, that would apply to Europeans, to Asians, to humpbacks, as Claude Anderson would say, and four-legged, you know, human beings, just anybody who is fortunate enough to be included in the human family. Now, of course, that's problematic for people of African descent, because at that time we were still trying to disprove, if you will, arguments of science that we weren't real humans, that we were some kind of subspecies of humans. So arguably, the report in itself was, the Declaration of Human Rights in itself was kind of a setup. But when I think about it, that whole working group of experts, and I should probably be careful how I say this if I want to be invited back again, it's
right,
a watered-down
right.
version of the event that took place at Liberty Hall when we were doing our own convention, where we had control of the forum, of what the themes were going to be, and everyone invited was an expert, an accredited representative of the race. We elected
right.
them, not the UN and their funds. So that is something notably that our people should take note, not to discourage people from participating in the process, because we must at least observe and come back and report, but to know what we had, what we lost, and what it was replaced with, so that we can operate from a body of knowledge and not ignorance. Because I assure you that the nation states that were there, if they didn't know, they are going right now, and they are studying, and they're pulling out their tools, and they're bracing for any updates that might be included, because that was epic. And it wasn't just epic because I said it, God bless my soul, but it was epic and historic, because as far as I know up to this date, no one had presented the UN working group of experts with any body of knowledge such as this. Lots of people were invoking the name of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey, but it was like in passing. For me, it was the purpose for being there, under the educated
right.
wisdom of the Honorable Amy Euphemia Jiggs Garvey, who I believe with the blessings of the Most High sent me there in the first place to continue her work when she established the Memorandum Correlative.
All right. Wonderful. Well, thank you, my sister, so much. We only have a few minutes left. I think I do see one caller that did have a question or comment, but caller, if you could just hold it just for a few minutes, because I've got to get this call in before we get locked out from the virtual, the live stream. The podcast is going to continue, but the live stream is going to cut off in about 5 minutes. But I need to connect with Chairman Fred before we're not able to do that. So, caller, I will be coming to you in a few minutes. I just need to get Chairman Fred in queue before that apparatus is shut down. So, Sister Sheila, if you would be so kind to just stay right there, I'd like to bring in Chairman Fred briefly to just share his views of yesterday at the press conference that was held here in Philly. Hey, Chairman. All right. I know you're always doing something, but I wanted to grab you real quick because before we closed out, it was good seeing you yesterday. And, you know, your words were so – yes, sir, your words were so powerful. I just wanted to ask you a quick question, my brother, and then next week or so or when you're available, we'll get you back on to really examine this. But I'm really kind of, you know, peed off. When Brother Mike conveyed that yes they do, he does have the mortgage piece, the whatever it is, and he did pay the down payment, but that he has to pay $400,000.
Like I said yesterday, I relate. Well, first, let me premise with this. I regretfully had to leave back to get back to Chicago. I wanted to make sure I was there. I left early this morning. I wanted to technically be there May 13th. And I just want to extend a clinch fist salute to the phenomenal move made. And Mike Africa Jr. And others, you know, it was historical. I still haven't landed, haven't come down, you know what I'm saying, and I talked to him, you know. We was correlating to, you know what I'm saying, even the moves at the Hampton House, so on and so forth. And as I said in my presentation, that I recall struggles I went through with people. People are saying it doesn't make any sense, you know, like financially, amongst other things, go to the Hampton House. Like, it was, you know, I mean, everything from the repairs that we made, just, you know, how much it costs, so on and so forth. But the statement made with that, you know, so many other dynamics. And I mean, it broke the ice with that move, you know what I'm saying? The reality is we're not in a position that we want to be in, you know what I'm saying? Whether we're talking about, you know, political prisoners, whether we're talking about reparations, whether we're talking about even, you know, putting our legacy back in place, but you know, we have to grab these moves, we have to up the ante, you know, because reality is we come from a deficit, you know, humbling. It's humbling to say we come from a deficit, and you know, so just to even have certain discussions about, I was studying the community yesterday when I was walking down the block, you know, studying the people, mm-hmm. And it was what happened. The way it happened, not only May 13, 1985, you know, to 1978, there's Ramon Africa talking about the continuous, you know what I'm saying, the continuous attacks the state of ways on, you know, it was done in a strategic way. Many people just, you know what I'm saying, was just even fearful to even acknowledge, you know, what happened there. So that was a leap. That was a leap. You know, just to get the conversation rolling, you know what I'm saying? Look at this protracted struggle again. We can look at different dynamics. So, you know what I'm saying? It hurts. It's insulting that we even have to have a discussion. Like, you know what I'm saying? In Haiti, the fact that, you know, they in debt in Haiti, the France, it doesn't make any logical, you know, sense, you know what I'm saying? But the deal is, you know, put in context again, we come from a deficit. But that hurts, and it's humbling to say that, but we fighting back, and we acknowledging certain dynamics, you know, the significance, and, you know, it's caused discussion. You say, well, what's to this? What's the significance of this? Why did they try to give them the runaround about, you know, they said they would sell it to anybody except him, you know what I'm saying? So what's to this? And people need to see these contradictions. Say, what's to this? Why would the state go to the state, you know what I'm saying? to fight for this discussion not to happen. And once the conversation happens, as Malcolm X says, that, you know, the collective consciousness of the people ticks slowly, but it erupts in the volcanic force that makes Mount St. Helens look like nothing.
And the other thing I need to point out, because I was remiss in mentioning this, at least tonight, I did mention it earlier today. The thing that also kind of is bothersome to me is that the developers that bought the property paid $1. And so with that said, that they paid one freaking dollar. And then now, you know, that has exploded into $400,000 that the property is now worth.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that's the thing that's a threat. So what we did today, Chairman Fred, is we took it to the community. I was at a session today, and you know I'm saying to Black folks in this city that they need to say something. I mean, if it doesn't go anywhere, it doesn't go anywhere. But to just sit back and just go, oh wow, or whatever, to say nothing, to not raise this in the public view, in our community in particular, that there's something wrong with this.
Mm-hmm.
You see? Mm-hmm. And so we're challenging the Black community here to at least, you know, see, again, my position is always now coming from the issue of reparatory justice. I'm not trying to rock and roll with them like we normally have. You know, in this day and age, there's been some headway in some other areas of things, and we need to assert that. And so for me, in certain things, I'm not going to try to deal with them the way, you know, way we normally would. I'm saying there are atrocities that have been inflicted upon our people for over 400 years, and it is time for there to be reparatory justice, restitution or something. Ain't going to be I'm giving you something. So I did talk to Mike about that the other day, and he understood it. He, you know, because it's an argument that has, you know, validity to it. It has weight to it. It might take, you know, some work and effort, but it's not like it's a, you know, an issue that can't be presented at some point in time. So he and I are going to talk about it further. But I just wanted to get your thoughts about it, brother, because we were all, I mean, yesterday was powerful. It's no question. It was powerful. I mean, wow. You know, to be in the midst of that and to feel, you know, what we felt. But I did get angry when I heard him say that. I was like, what?
And we got to keep it up. We got to even, you know, remain consistent. Like even engaging in a discussion and like right or wrong, because this system, everything we talk about, the educational system, we talk about, you know, in the court system, people say, well, this makes logical sense. I mean, situation in New York on a subway train, you know, because Jordan Neely, you know, say how, you know, Daniel Perry, this, I mean, the fact that, you know, saying, you look at the initial statement by the governor of New York initially, the first response, it doesn't make any logical sense. I mean, it took this brother 15 minutes at minimum. You know what I'm saying? And people right there. Mm-hmm. And you know,
yep.
So you can get any company. You know, power, as President Douglas said, power concedes nothing without demand. We have to up the ante, be very clear that, you know, this, I think we get morality mixed up with legality. You know what I'm saying? We have to recognize that politics trumps everything. You know what I'm saying? That we have, our political muscle has to be tightened up. We have to do a lot of working out. You know what I'm saying? Up the ante. You know what I'm saying? The code of force to reckon with. You know what I'm saying? And it, you know, we can't. And the reality is that I can put him on so many moves. Like, you can't wait on a lot of forces to get, you know what I'm saying, to get in shape. You have to see the time. You got to move.
That's
know?
Right. That's
I reminded this brother yesterday. I remember even, you know, with the Hampton House. It was still today. You know what I'm saying? When there were attacks and struggling, you know, naysayers. You know what I'm saying? And people, you know, had no faith in it. And the building next to the Hampton House was but my cousin died in a fire, a mysterious fire, 43 years ago. That building stayed abandoned. It was raccoons, rats, everything. You know, it was nine overdoses right there in that building next door. You know, people, you know, in the Hampton House, when we got there, people laid out, you know what I'm saying, when he was down, we clean house. So technically, you would say, well, why don't they give us that property right next door? As soon as we get the historical landmark status, the very next day, the developers came in and got the building next door to the Hampton House. It's in a bed for 43 years. Nine overdoses. We put a garden right there. Then once we did the work, we can show case after case, like, you know, how we can deal with crime. You know, say just the presence that you can see people come back and say yesterday, the discussions that's happened, so on and so forth. And we talk about, you know, like crime in our community. People say, well, it doesn't make sense. They constantly go on funding it to these different, you know, organizations and state institutions, and the crime is continued. And people say they confused. I said, well, if you believe that the system want to stop crime, you believe Don King want to stop boxing.
Right. Oh, God.
But another sad reality is, I was just coming, I know you're on time, I know the time is on, we're timing, but we have been, the reality also, our people, we have success we're dealing with. We are, you know what I'm saying, and I say this again, and it hurts to say this, we damaged goods. We've been affected by imperialism.
Right.
It's a movie called, it's a show called Snowfall.
You heard of it? Oh, yeah.
Look at the response from people.
Yep.
At the end of the movie. Majority of people, the masses.
Wow,
They hurt. You know why they hurt? Because they believe in capital. They want capitalism to survive.
Yep, I saw the last episode.
Regardless of, and people want him. They want a success story. They want him to walk up, be successful. Regardless of all the detriment to our community, to our people, what you know, say the American. Some even politicians say, ironically, not that the black people, you know, be like the most conservative audience. Sad to say.
Wow. Yeah, that was an interesting little series.
Phenomenal.
I mean, that dude acted that whole thing. I mean, he was really, really good in that. But on another note, have you got a chance to see Dear Mama yet?
No, I haven't. I was going to wait to all the episodes, similar to like Snowfall.
Okay. Yeah.
Watch everything in one time.
Okay. Yeah. And I got to say, I was expecting something a little more. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. So it definitely was surprising that it wasn't as a problem.
Say it again. It wasn't as what?
As much propaganda.
As much propaganda.
You know. So, you know, it did allow, or we did see some things that I think was relatively genuine or legit. In for example, Mama Afeni's sister. In her interviews and a few others, that, you know, it was real, at least from my perspective. So I was kind of surprised that they allow, you know, that kind of energy and representation to come through. So, you know, we'll see.
So you put it in context of time. I mean, I get to view it yet, but with a force, with a phenomenon, you know what I'm saying, with a force such as Park, in a time like this, in particular, I mean, he always was, as he said, you know, says it was a rose that grew out of the concrete. I mean, you know, what I'm saying all throughout the script, but in particular, right now, you look at this, you know, as he said, also, if you think I'm something, wait till you see what they bring out after me. You look at the status of hip hop. You look at the status of hip hop, and it's how it's saturated. That's our community.
Right.
I mean, how we so saturated with slop. You know what I'm saying? I mean, saturated. I was looking at some. It was draining yesterday. It's about eight or 9 year old boy. They bring it out. They pushing real heavy right now. They reference him as Lil King.
There in Chicago.
No, Memphis. I think Memphis, Mississippi.
Oh,
Memphis.
Oh gosh, yeah, the Dirty South thing is crazy.
This was really not even. I mean, not even with him. I gotta tell people about. You look at the adults. It's the reinforcements. How people going along with it? It's mind blowing. You know what I'm saying? And it's mind blowing. The stage we in, and so it must, in times such as these, again that which is really a dime a dozen. Where you look, it's everywhere. So you really climate is like a thirst. To say, okay, well. Force like people and I tell people like a lot of times even with us organized the Black Panther Party Cubs, we last call for alcohol, and that's the reality. The sister said, Chairman, I don't like when you say that. I said, well, it's the reality. We are the ones that people can they look when they seek out when under intense conditions. If the climate permits. They go,
right.
They go for other dynamics, but now even with that hip hop, it's so saturated with slop that you have a conversation to put out. It's not nothing unique to put out a documentary about a rapper now. In fact, they say, they talking about already how it's broke all records, broke all these records, with their mama. You have to, And again, the phenomenon of Pac is a different dynamic. How you want to cut it.
Oh yeah, no doubt. All right, my brother. I know you are doing something because you're always doing something. So I'm not going to hold you, but I appreciate you taking the time to share with us. And hearing you yesterday and hearing Mike yesterday, it just really kind of hit me last night, We had Mona on last night.
Clutch the salute for Mona the Move family, so Mike Africa Junior, Mike Africa Senior, Debbie Africa. Consistency, I was honored and humbled to be able to touch down there,
Pam
and everybody else, and just as I say yesterday, under contested conditions, they stood strong under the contested conditions.
Yep. No doubt, and I've seen Mike Senior and Debbie Africa. To see them together,
Yes. I was watching them. I said, for granted, like they just here, but you can't take it for granted. You cannot take it for granted. They're here. And put in context, he was born in Mike Ivory Jr., born in jail. And they come out and steal in that relationship, So it's inspiring.
It is. All right, family. Again, we're going to get ready to close this session out. Chairman, I'm going to bring one caller in because she was kind enough. I think it might be Mama Kandi. That's why I want to bring her in while you're still on, because I think she would like to holler at you if it is her. I'm not sure because I don't have my glasses on, but I'm going to try. So we're going to go to caller at 9462. I think that's what it is. And 9462, your mic is open.
Can y'all hear me?
Yep, we don't have a lot of time, though. Yes, Mama.
Yes, indeed.
How you doing?
Look, We're on this end. Love, respect. Love, respect. Yes, indeed.
Bless you, sweetie. You know, I always have this generational pride when you're concerned.
Right on. I'm honored and humbled.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. What I want to share tonight is in line with both you, Chairman Fred, and with the work you're doing, with you, Empress Chi, and the work you do, and the sister that was on earlier and the work she's doing.
She's still with us.
Oh, you're still with us? Oh, bless your heart.
I'm here.
What I want to say is y'all all remind me, I'm 71. Y'all all remind me of work we did in the 60s in our struggle in building institutions. And we're still doing, of course, as advisors and consultants now, especially in my situation, being blind in a wheelchair and facing homelessness. But we still do. And y'all make me remember how we did it, because we built independent African-centered schools. We delivered babies at home for our people, and we never got paid.
Mm-hmm.
How we survived doing that is an amazing thing that I'm only now remembering and thinking about and strategizing for the next generations to be able to survive, because I hear a lot of folks say, well, we can't do that, you know, how are we going to get paid? How are we going to eat? How are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? And I remember making arrangements with other sisters my age, coming to an agreement that we just were never going to work a 9-to-5 job. We weren't. We would hustle. We would sell our art and our wares, and we would take everything that we could from the system, whether it was disability or food stamps or welfare or whatever we could get our hands on that we didn't have to pay cash for. That way we could eat, pay our bills, and still work full-time for the struggle. Mm. It was a strategy that was excellent, and you never really hear about it, because most of the time when you think of welfare, you think of sisters trying to get over on the system, or, you know, sisters who are not doing anything positive, or they're getting high, or they're getting drunk, or, you know, they're doing drugs, or they're smoking, or whatever. That's all we hear about. But we don't hear about the sisters who use the imperialist system for the benefit of our own system. And y'all made me remember that. Thank you. Thank you for making me remember. Thank you.
Right on. Love, respect. Yes, indeed.
Thank you, Mama.
Yes,
all
indeed.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, family. Well, as you all can tell, you know, this day or this time period is a very heartfelt one. I think we're all feeling some things as a result of May 13th and Mother's Day and, the whole thing. But the bottom line is we are as committed to doing the work that needs to be done. And so, you know, I'm glad we were able to catch Chairman Fred for a few moments. Of course, we got Mama Connie.
I'll be missed also, Mama Connie. So it was happy Mother's Day today and every day also. Forgive me.
Your mama.
Thank you.
Thank you, Baba. Thank you, brother. And yep. How's your mom? How's your mother?
She's good. In fact, I'm touch down with her before the night is out. Yep. I just talked to her an hour ago. Yep. She's still fighting. Yes,
indeed. You let her know we definitely like to get her with us in September or October, because we're going to be doing a special thing of what we call real mothers, daughters, sisters of the movement. All right, and we're going to be paying tribute to real mother, daughters, and sisters of the movement, because you know the system got this other stuff out there called mothers of the movement.
Yeah.
And so we said, no, we not. We got to show the people something else. And so I talked to Sister Dequee the other day, and so she's going to help me to remember those who have already made Transistor, like Sophia Bakari, Mama Afeni, and others. And so in September, October, we're going to play tribute to real mothers, daughters of the movement. So
yes,
keep
indeed.
That in mind. So please let your mom know we definitely want to include her in that. Some of them have already made transition, but some of them are still with us. So.
Yes.
We feel that it's our obligation to show, particularly the younger folks, real mothers and daughters and sisters of the movement. And it's not to take anything away from, you know, the people who have lost their loved ones, but not what we're talking about as being mothers of the movement. You know, I mean, all kinds of people have tragedies and loss. They don't make them the mother or something. You know? So we just need some clarity there. So please give your regards to your mom and let her know we definitely need, to have her presence with us so that we can show at least the younger generation that these are real mothers and daughters and sisters of the movement.
Yes, indeed.
You know.
Yep.
All right, Chairman, I thank you again, as usual. I'm going to be heading to Chirac in about another month because we're organizing for the Million Woman World March.
Right on. Keep us posted. Yes, indeed.
Well, you know I will. All right. All right, family, listen, we're going to move on out because we had a long day, a long weekend, actually. And, you know, Jim and Fred just flew in and flew right back out. We were trying to crab them. we had to get back. So we understand. But listen, family, we thank everyone again. And we will be back next week, same time. So, listen, I'm going to give you all some quick closing comments. Mama Condi. Give you your closing comments first, Chairman Fred, and then, of course, Sister Sheila, I'll have you to close this out. Mama Condi, your thoughts.
My thoughts. I am blind now in a wheelchair, and I've been issued an eviction again. It's only been 2 months since the last eviction was presented. It's a new experience for me. I've never had a black landlord. I never had a white landlord before. This is the first time. And it is a nightmare. I've had black people who were loony as bedbugs, but they weren't vicious like these people are that I'm dealing with now. And I realize how the struggle has insulated brothers and sisters like me from infancy to my present age. As for the Mother's Day thing, thank you. Give us our flowers while we are alive. I accept.
Yes.
I yield. Thank you.
That's right. Thank you, Mama Karen.
It's interesting, Mama Condi talks a bit, mentioned that. I don't know. I mean, me and Mike Africa Jr. had some, some 101 intense dialogue yesterday, some intense dialogue. And she has brought back, you know, he was talking about different dynamics, you know, like, you know, even, not going into all detail, like the, a lot of elders and stuff, you know, Walita Jamal, and this before her passing, and
right.
And just, you know, like, we want to, it's humbling to say, you know, we want to fight for a space. His brain is moving. Mike Africa Jr. again. His brain is moving. He's not resting on the Lord of that move. He's still thinking some other moves and
sure.
And I just, you know, in this, and ironically he was talking about that yesterday. That's the, like, you know, just the situation, you know, a lot of people look at this, you know, movements and struggles in a reactionary way, just see you at the what happens. I think about even stories of Fannie Lou Hamer, the struggle she had to go through just get her hair braided in the later years. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts. It's humble. You know what I'm saying? It, mm-hmm. it's not a glorious part. You know what I'm saying? Of a glorious, you know, war story. You know, what have you? We really, you know, we don't fight the position again that we could have, you know, situations set up for, you know, advisors, you know, saying I'm, you know, because there's no retirement for the struggle, you know, because they don't forget the system. They have a long range memory. They don't forget. They keep tabs on us, you know, so even, I mean, you know, to the grave and after, they study our DNA, all that, you know. And so I look forward to the day that's something, you know, saying, that we really got to work on, you know, to get the position that we can, you know, saying, have stuff in place. That, you know, saying, that we taken care of, and it's not just a trivial senior care sort of discussion. We talk about prisoners. In the context of war, they look at how we deal with our prisoners, look at, you know, say, how we deal with, you know, say, our people, you know what I'm saying? And it's a statement. And it's something that's not deployed. I mean, and I tell people all the time, don't get it twisted. The system, they cover down on, like, when they talk about, they put out this front, I mean, look how they treat their veterans. In reality, they don't take care of them. And you look, and like, even, some TV show called late at night, some of those in Nazi Germany, you know, the older people in their respective community, they don't take care of them, you know what I'm saying? They know it's important enough to put out a facade that they take care of them. We want to, you know,
right.
be authentic, you know what I'm saying? Again, this is a discussion that we have to have, and we have to intertwine it, you know what I'm saying? Again, with every aspect of our struggle, like people say, well, we talk about political prisons, senior care, we're talking about children. I mean, this is intertwined with discussion. I mean, it was the foster care, everything. So again, everything is political. So we really, you know, I'm glad she mentioned that. So we just really try to struggle, you know, up to any and every aspect of this struggle.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chairman. All right, Sister Sheila. Your closing comments.
Well, family, I am both discouraged and inspired. I hate to say that, but there is something that is undergirding the inspired part, and it's something that's operating in the unseen that says you're not alone. We've been here before. We're going to guide you through this. Just listen to the sound of our voice. And so that's what I'm relying on, family. And I would advise you to find your own way of coping with this and listening for the voice, because we're at a very pivotal point in world history that the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey foresaw and did everything in his power to prevent, including sacrificing the well-being financially, spiritually, and otherwise of his own family to prevent it. But we're here now. And it's manifesting in every possible way, whether medically, economically, in housing and politics and we have returned to the 1920s era, and only the blind will have a difficult time to see what our ancestors were contending with, the lynchings, the public displays of hostility. The only difference is now, instead of just Europeans participating in the process, we have these ancillary Europeans in the form of Asians and Hispanics, and sometimes even Negroes who are wholeheartedly, wholesale benefiting from the enslavement, the re-enslavement, or the re-pronounced enslavement of African people at a global level. So we're not going to be able to save us all. Many of us don't even want to recognize that we're in trouble and don't want to do anything differently besides watch music videos, laugh and dance and drink and bingo their way out of this situation's pain. And so for those of us who are paying attention and getting into the uncomfortable positions of survival, for whatever that might look like for you, more power to you. I encourage you to link up with like-minded individuals and then allow the ancestors and the Most High to do the rest after you have done your part to prepare yourself.
Hello.
All right. Well, family, again, this has been a powerful conversation, as usual. And again, we want to thank everyone for sharing. Thank you, Sister Sheila, for that. And we'll be back next week, y'all. Tammy Fried, are you still doing your Wednesday program?
Yes, indeed. Wednesday, 6:30 p.m. Central Time, 8:30 p.m. Central Time, FreeMR Radio, FREEMRAL Radio. Then go and subscribe to my YouTube channel, Chairman Fred Jr., Chairman Fred Jr., again, every Wednesday, 2:30 p.m.
All right. All right, family, you heard it right here. Of course, again, tomorrow, Brother Lee Robinson is Africa on the Move at 7 o'clock. And, of course, every week is Sister Keisha, and she's Thorough Black Talk every Thursday at 8 o'clock. So, family, listen, stay in tune because we've got a lot coming this week. We're going to be doing a couple of special editions. But, of course, you know we'll be back our regular time next week. Remember, free Mumia Abu Jamal, free them all, all of our prisoners. Absolutely, absolutely. And you know what we say, family, if there's no justice, there's no what, y'all?
No peace.
Until next time, we say Pamoja to the Shinda. Together, we shall win. Oh, yeah, we shall. Love y'all. Talk to you the next time.
Love you.
Peace out.
Peace out.
Peace out.